In the early 1950s, Alan Garner, now a famous novelist and then a keen athlete, used to train around the lanes of North Cheshire. He fell into the company of a fellow runner, a stocky, barrel-chested man, he recalls, with a high-pitched Donnish voice and the aerodynamics of a brick. Witty and funny, the man talked endlessly as they ran about mathematics and biology. The runner's name was Alan Turing, and he was the brilliant, talented mathematician whose pioneering work in early computing and wartime code-breaking left a legacy which still has a huge impact on our daily lives. I'm Adam Walton, and this week, on the centenary of Alan Turing's birth, the Science Cafe commemorates the father of modern computing. Alan Turing's ideas for a form of programmable computing machine are the origin of the computers we all use today, and the application of Turing's brilliant mathematical mind to wartime code-breaking at Bletchley Park earned him an OBE in 1945. However, persecution for his homosexuality brought to an end both his groundbreaking career and ultimately his own life, when he committed suicide at the age of 41. In today's programme, we discuss Turing's contribution to computer science, his revolutionary work helping to crack German codes in the Second World War, and his influence on many of today's scientists and mathematicians. I'm joined by Sir Roger Penrose, Professor of Mathematics at the University of Oxford, Professor Barry Cooper from the University of Leeds, who's chair of the organising committee for the Turing Centenary, and Dr. Tom Crick, a senior lecturer in computing science at Cardiff Metropolitan University. Welcome all. Now, in my introduction, I described Alan Turing as the father of modern computing. Is that a reasonable description? And just how important is he, Roger?
I think he is. I mean, there's certainly other figures who have had a big influence on the development of modern computers. I mean, von Neumann was one of them. But I think Turing can be said as being genuinely the father of modern computing. He introduced the idea of what is called now a Turing machine, and a universal Turing machine, which is a machine which can imitate any other. And this universal Turing machine can do anything which is a completely automatic procedure. So I think this is his great achievement, was to introduce this notion. There are other people who had been playing with this idea too, but I think Turing's idea of a general computer was more persuasive than the ones that others had introduced.
Barry, is there a particular reason why Turing's idea was more persuasive and you know, for his reputation that we're celebrating in this programme?
Well, I think what's very special about Turing is that he was interested both in the theory and in, if you like, the real world, the engineering and the actual physical building of computers. And his contribution in both areas was very very significant. Of course, he was only around 23, 24 when he wrote this amazing paper in 1936, and it's this that people usually think of in relation to Turing's legacy. It was an amazing feat for a young man, and it laid the foundations of computer science and the actual building of computers.
Tom, in the world of mathematics and computing, Turing has given his name to two major ideas. One is the Turing test, which we'll talk about a little later in the programme. The other is the Turing machine, an idea he proposed in the late 1930s. What is the Turing machine?
Yeah, so the Turing machine's a theoretical sort of conceptual computational machine. So it's not as if we're talking about physical hardware or any sort of machine that we use today. Turing's model that he kind of laid down in his seminal 1936 paper and sort of followed up with some other kind of essays in the 1940s, it was essentially to fully encapsulate the possibility. So this is where this is the kind of the profound leap from some of the mathematical foundations of actually looking at what's computable and actually thinking about what is meant by computation. So actually, how do we solve problems? So the Turing machine is a sort of a hypothetical device. It's basically it relies on having infinite memory, which is something that's obviously impossible in the real world. But essentially, the Turing machine laid down the foundations for modelling computation, and then this concept of a universal Turing machine, or a universal machine which can then essentially mimic the behaviour of any other Turing, any possible Turing machine, led into the work of von Neumann and actually the development of actual physical computer devices.
And Barry, how revolutionary was this idea at the time? Or were there other mathematicians working towards a similar idea?
There was one key idea which Turing was responsible for largely, which was the idea that instead of each time you wanted to do a particular computing job, you built a new machine. What you did was you programmed one particular machine to do lots of different jobs. And the really key idea that Turing had was the idea that you could represent your program, your computing program, as data, which was just the same as the data that you were computing on. So you could feed in your program into your computer. It could be stored away for future use. And that's essentially what our laptop or our desktop computer is doing now. It's you don't change the hardware each time you want to do a particular job. You just feed in a new program and put it on one side until you want to use it again.
And I think I should introduce another point that Turing was very strong on making, namely that there are things which you cannot compute. I mean, the fact that there are non-computable concepts was also very much part of what Turing did. He demonstrated that there were classes of mathematical problem that you simply cannot compute in an automatic way.
Is it possible for you to give us an example of that, so we can visualize it?
There are examples that one can say. One of the most straightforward one was a problem set by Hilbert, basically, at the beginning of the 20th century, in which you had to see whether you could solve algebraic equations with integers. And the problem is, does a set of equations have a solution in terms of ordinary whole numbers? And does it or doesn't it, you see? And this question turns out to be a non-computable problem. There is no computer program which will universally answer correctly, yes or no, whether this system of equations can be solved with whole numbers.
Barry, let's go back to Alan Turing's early life. How early did his brilliance become apparent? Was he a prodigy?
Well, I would say no. he was a prodigy, but it wasn't recognised. I think if you go back to his, you can nowadays see his school reports from Sherborne on the web. The archivist there has very kindly got them put up for people to read. And you can see that he was kind of an eccentric lad. He was very geekish. He was interested in origami, and he was unorganized and untidy in the way a lot of very clever young kids are. And it was only slowly that they recognized his brilliance. And I think by the time he left to go to Cambridge, there were great admirers at Sherborne and so on, and they did realise they were dealing with somebody very special. I should just say that nowadays, if you talk to people who knew Turing, and unfortunately there are not so many people now who did, they all seem to say, well, as soon as they met him, they were clear that they were in the presence of a genius.
You're listening to the Science Cafe on BBC Radio Wales, and today we're looking back over the life and legacy of mathematician Alan Turing. Now, during the Second World War, Turing was a part of the team at the Government Code and Cipher School, a top-secret establishment of codebreakers at Bletchley Park. There, Turing played a key role in developing techniques to decode German military messages, which had been encoded with the Enigma machine. At the recent Hay Festival, Science Cafe producer Jeremy Grange caught up with Simon Singh, author of The Code Book, A History of Codes and Codebreaking, and asked him how Turing was recruited to Bletchley Park.
They put the word out. They started asking Oxford dons, Cambridge professors, who are the right people to help break these German codes. And I guess one professor spoke to another professor, and another professor spoke to Turing, and somebody tapped Turing on the shoulder and said, look, we're going to need you over here. It was a real hodgepodge of people at Bletchley. There were museum curators, there were classic scholars, but there was this new breed of cryptographer, the mathematician, the engineer, The person that could think ruthlessly, logically, but also creatively, which is what you also need.
So what would you say that the specific insights that the Turing brought to code breaking?
Okay, I think the you can look at code encryption as an equation. You have three parts to the equation. You have the input, which is the message. You have the encryption settings for the Enigma, and then you have the output. So input plus Enigma settings give output. Now, if you're a British interceptor, what do you have? Well, all you have is the output, this message, this garbled gobbledygook that you've intercepted. You don't know what was the input was, that's what you desperately want, and you don't know what the settings of the Enigma machine were. That's what you'd like to get as well in order to get the original message. So it's an equation with two unknowns. What Turing focused on was to say, what about if we can get just a small part of the input? Maybe there's a routine way that messages start. Maybe every message contains the time it was sent. And we know the time it was sent because that's the time we intercepted it. Maybe if messages are about weather, we know what the weather was like in that area where the message originated from. And so I think he focused on, if we know a little bit of the input and we've got the output, because that's what we've intercepted, then we can begin. It's now an equation with only one unknown, which is the settings of the machine. And if you focus on that, you can work out those settings. And once you've got the settings of that machine, then you can begin to decrypt lots of other messages sent that day.
That was Simon Singh on Alan Turing's role as a codebreaker at Bletchley Park during the Second World War. Now, and Barry, Simon Singh mentioned one of Alan Turing's insights which helped in cracking German secret codes, but what were his other achievements at Bletchley Park?
Well, I mean, I think one of the most important things that he brought to Bletchley Park was the use of machines for number crunching and doing fantastic decoding jobs that a human decryptor couldn't do. He did depend on work done by in Poland and by people overseas, but he brought the techniques to a new level, applied them in creative ways, and he had a huge impact on what people were doing at Bletchley Park.
There are accounts from those years of Turing's eccentricities. Can you detail some of those for us, Barry?
Oh, there's just so many of them. But I mean, you know, the chaining of his mug to a radiator so that people wouldn't steal it, and then of course somebody pinched the key one day, and he had to sit on the floor drinking his coffee with a mug chained to the radiator. But there's things like cycling into work with a gas mask on, to avoid hay fever or whatever, and then during the war he buried silver ingots as a kind of protection against losing his money, and then later on he went back to try and he had a map, he went back to try and find his buried treasure and never did find it, and people are still looking for it now.
So we're detailing Roger an eccentric character, but it's important to stress, and it has been stressed hitherto obviously, the importance of Turing to the war effort. So could you outline how important he was to the war effort?
Well, I think he was crucial when it came to the Enigma machine, because that was the code that was generally used by the Germans during the war. And then when the naval, I think the naval machine used an extra cog or something, and this was flummoxing people for a while, and they had to, I think, capture something from a submarine. I can't remember all the stories about this now, but certainly the general Enigma machine, the decoding of that was very much a Turing thing. There was also the something I think called the Fish Code that the Germans used, Hitler used with his generals, and the Colossus machine was developed in order to crack that one as well. And I think Turing had a role to play in that, not quite so much as he did in the Enigma. That he obviously had a huge impact.
Barry, did anybody at Bletchley Park know about his sexuality? Would he have been dismissed if anybody had suspected he was homosexual?
Well, I think one of the attractive features of Turing was that he was incredibly honest, and you knew who he was. He and I don't think he was he didn't do more than hide his sexuality for obvious reasons at that time. Now, when he was in Manchester later in his life, there was really no reason why he should hide his sexuality to his friends and I think that he did anticipate to some extent that he might get into problems with the law later on, but he was I think he put honesty before dissembling to people. And he was, in a sense, he's iconic to many people in the gay community nowadays because of this this honesty and this willingness to be who he was.
Science Cafe on BBC Radio Wales.
Now, after the war, Turing worked at the National Physical Laboratory, where he was involved in the development of one of the earliest electronic computers, the Automatic Computing Engine, or ACE for short. His assistants at the laboratory were Jim Wilkinson and Michael Woodger. And when Michael spoke to Jeremy Grange from his home in Yorkshire, he recalled his first meeting with Alan Turing.
Very friendly. He had his own agenda. I never wanted to or succeeded in deviating from the line he was taking at any moment, but very, very pleasant with me anyway.
I believe there's a story about you were off for a while with glandular fever and he wrote you a letter.
Yes, I've got it in front of me. It was a wonderful thing. This is written by Alan Turing, finding himself Alan, to my great surprise, and it says, "Dear Woodger, unfortunately, Wilkinson and I have both arranged to go on leave, just this moment when you are coming back." And he goes on to say, "I expect you can keep yourself fairly busy, though. A list of things he could do, I could do, try and help other people in the division doing ace jobs, read the folder, read some good book, relax." And then he finally ends up, "I hope you really are all right. It's a shame to have you come back and find the place deserted. You might be wise to have a relapse for a week." I mean, for one's boss to suggest one has takes a week, that's like that. Very uncivil service.
But very kind.
Very, very kind. Charming man.
And that charm did come out. You sort of get the impression that perhaps somebody who was working intellectually at the level he was perhaps be a little awkward with people socially.
Well, only if they were trying to use the conversation for their ends in some way. Oh, he has a cunning technique. If he was trying to say something and you tended to be butting in, he'd start a stutter like a machine gun to stop you, to get his word in. Just like like that. Very funny.
So how long did you work with him?
Unfortunately, only a year, because he quit after a year with me. Because nothing was happening. He wanted to get a machine built as soon as possible. It didn't have to be his design. And it was clear that we were getting nowhere at NPL. Hearing about his death was a sad thing. I tried to understand it, and so did Wilkinson. And we talked about it a bit. You see, even though I stayed with him 2 years before he died, I was completely innocent of his homosexuality. It wasn't a thing that entered my horizon. Even when we went into his lounge in the evening, the first thing he did was to turn the light off. He carried on chatting about some abstruse mathematics, to which I responded. And he didn't sort of reach over and touch me or anything like that. But I really wondered what's going on. I had no clue about homosexuality.
That was Michael Woodger, Alan Turing's assistant at the National Physical Laboratory in the late 1940s. Barry, so at the National Physical Laboratory and later at Manchester University, how important was Alan Turing's contribution to turning the electronic computer into reality?
Well, the thing about Turing was that he had a very ambitious vision of what he wanted to do in the way of computing. And he took things to a new level, definitely, when he got to Manchester. And he had two very important directions he took there. One was with the Turing test and trying to pin down what was intelligence, the human intelligence. And the other was the biology. And strangely enough, one of the most original and innovative things he did was to work out mathematically how patterns on animals' hides, like on cows' backs and patterns on tropical fish and so on, how they happened. And I guess a normal person would look at these things and not think twice. You know, they're given to us by nature. Turing wanted to work out the mathematics that underlay these things. And this points to all sorts of modern developments. And this, the paper that he wrote, just one paper on this topic about patterns in nature, it is actually his most cited paper. And the people working in bioinformatics and so on, that's how they know Turing. And this work isn't so well known to the computer scientists, but it is really very, very important.
Barry, you mentioned the Turing test. Roger, could you explain what the Turing test is for us, please?
Well, the idea is that, you know, can you, or can a machine think, I think, is the sort of question that it's trying to address. Or is a machine conscious like a person? And the question is that you ask it various questions, but you don't know. You have the device hidden from you. There's an interrogator who tries to decide whether the replies to questions put by the interrogator are given by a machine or by a human being. And so they're both, the human being and the machine, are hidden from the interrogator. And the interrogator's job is to put questions in such a way that could distinguish one from the other. And the job of the computer is to try and imitate a human being as best as possible, so that they can't be the interrogator can't tell the which is which.
I think just the wider concept of artificial intelligence is around that sort of time, like the late 1940s, early 1950s, the phrase artificial intelligence didn't even exist. But that was the focus of a lot of Turing's work, kind of later work. And so there was an interesting point about, you know, how trying to model, using mechanical devices to model how a human brain works is, you know, clearly a very significant and complex task. But in his 1950 paper, this Computing Machinery and Intelligence, he suggested that it would be, rather than trying to build a program that could sort of simulate an adult mind, it would be better to produce a simpler one kind of basically simulating a child's mind and actually educate it. So, you know, this is where you have the intersection of mathematics, logic, computer science, and actually into things like sort of psychology and neuroscience, and actually the concept of what we mean by intelligence, and actually, you know, how the human brain works, and what do we mean by sentience, I suppose. So there's actually some profound philosophical concepts here too.
There's also, I think, there was a radio program in which Turing commented, I can't remember what the date of this was, but it was, he commented on the Manchester machine, which was, I suppose, the best, the first real general purpose computer. And the question is, when could you have a machine which could behave as a human brain does? And he argued, well, we may need something a few hundred times as powerful as the Manchester machine. Of course, from our modern perspective, this is ridiculous, because machines have got so much more powerful than the ones in those days that a few hundred or thousand times is nothing. But we still, as we've heard, haven't found machines that can pass the Turing test. So there is something more, which is certainly not encapsulated purely in computer power.
Indeed. Now, Barry, Turing committed suicide in 1954 at the age of 41. What were the events leading up to his death?
Well, of course, there's the famous court case. He had a fairly innocent liaison with a young man, and after that, his house was burgled by a friend of the young man that he had the relationship with, and he went to the police. And then, of course, it turned out that the police became more interested in Turing's private life than the fact his house had been burgled, and he was prosecuted under the laws as they were then, which have now, of course, changed. And he underwent medical treatments, which was an alternative to a custodial sentence, and this had a dramatic effect on him. And he lost his social life. He was affected both physically and mentally, maybe, by the treatment he took. And within 2 years, he was dead. It was a very tragic and a terrible thing for such a national hero to have encountered this treatment.
Hmm. Roger, as well as celebrating and commemorating Turing's life, is the centenary also an opportunity to remind people of the importance of mathematics and computer science?
I think that's a good point too, yes. I mean, he was a mathematician, and he did introduce powerful mathematical ideas which have this relationship to these devices which influence our lives to such a degree. So I think that's undoubtedly true.
Tom, was his true contribution to mathematics and computer science only fully recognised after his death and after the stigma of his death had passed?
Yeah, I think so. I think if you look at it, partly there was an aspect of national security, so we didn't fully understand his contributions until some of the information was released about Bletchley Park and sort of right. Cryptography in general. It's only over the past 10-15 years that we've actually, I think, the wider sort of public perception of Turing as a figure, as a significant British scientist, has actually come to the wider public consciousness. And I think that's partly because of the interest in what happened at Bletchley during the war. And so a recognition of the actual of Britain's rich heritage in computing, and that's really important nowadays when we discuss things like computer science education and sort of the discussion of science and its contribution to the economy. Then yeah, I think it's you can see why he's heralded as this really really key figure in the development of the discipline.
Tom, Roger, Barry, thank you very much for joining us this week and giving us an opportunity to celebrate the contribution of Alan Turing to computing and the life of a fascinating man as well. There will be much more information about Turing on the Science Cafe website, where you can also listen to the programme again. Visit bbc.co.uk/Radio Wales and select Science Cafe from the menu of programmes.